I'm Raphael.
I'm Kirk.
And this is the Housing Problem. In previous episodes of this podcast, and please do catch up now at thehousingproblem.com, we've spoken with an all-star ensemble of legislators, housing officials, advocates, and other leading voices in the housing space.
Hey, Raph, you mind if I take a turn at doing that intro?
Why? You don't like mine? What's the problem? You don't like the catch up to thehousingproblem.com?
No, it's good. But, you know, you just got to keep things fresh in any relationship. You know what I mean?
All right. Well, we'll have your people talk to my people, but I'm not making any promises.
All right. That's fine. In the meantime, one topic we've come back to over and over again is this issue of homelessness. Because at the end of the day, what bigger housing problem could there be than the problem of not having a home?
Yeah, I mean, that is fundamentally, you know, the most severe housing problem that we face. And it's totally true. And that's why, you know, I really believe that it's so deserving of our attention and spending as much time on it as we can. And today, we're going to be spending some more time talking about this issue. And we have a great guest to help bring a more national perspective to this discussion and to understanding, you know, why homelessness is ultimately a housing problem. I'm Raphael Sestero. I'm the chief executive officer of the Community Preservation Corporation. I've spent over 30 years in affordable housing in New York and across the country, including time as the commissioner of the New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. I'm president of Monadnock Development. I've been involved in affordable housing over 30 years, and I'm really passionate about it.
So together, Kirk and I have over 60 years of experience in housing in New York City and share a passion for trying to solve the housing problem. All right, Kirk. So about a year ago, I heard about this book called Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And of course, the title caught my attention.
Was that when you were Googling our podcast to see how many listeners we had?
Well, yes, that's true. It was. But the book kept coming up. And so fast forward to not too long ago, I was asked to speak on a panel on the housing supply shortage in New York State at an event hosted by the Robin Hood Foundation. And there was another panel at the beginning of the event that was on homelessness. And one of the speakers was our guest today, a guy by the name of Greg Colburn, who I immediately recognized as the guy who wrote the book that I was so excited about, a year prior to that.
That's amazing coincidence. So housing is a big problem, but it really is a small world. So the full title of the book Greg co-authored is Homelessness is a Housing Problem, How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. Greg is a professor in the Rundstedt Department of Real Estate in the College of Built Environments at the University of Washington, where he teaches classes in housing, urban development, and finance. He earned his PhD degree from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and his research is often featured in media outlets like The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Economist, and NPR.
Greg, thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Housing Problem.
Thanks, Raphael.
It's great to have you here. I was really looking forward to speaking to you, at the Robin Hood event. You know, it was so great to hear you speak about the homelessness being really driven by housing supply issues and our inability to keep up with demand. And the way you talked about sort of homelessness as a housing problem was really powerful. But there was a long line of folks. You were a popular guy that day, and I had to jump onto my own panel that day. And so, you know, we like to kick off our conversations with our guests with a little bit of an intro by you in sort of telling us a little bit about your story, how you ended up so interested in housing, why housing has been something that you've focused, you know, your time and energy and research and professional career on. We find it's an interesting way to get to know people and for people to sort of see that lots of us are focused on this issue and we come to it from different ways and different places. So if you could just share a little bit with the listener about your journey and how housing sparked a passion in you, helped you carry that out through your career.
Sure. Well, thank you, Kirk. Thanks, Raphael, for having me on. I appreciate it. I've got a somewhat unique career background for an academic. My first career was actually in finance. I started out in New York City, where you guys are based right now.
Yeah.
I was an investment banker for Goldman Sachs and lived on the Upper West Side and would take the subway downtown every day to work. And I'm a Midwestern guy, so New York City was a bit intimidating for me. But this was 1995. Giuliani was mayor. and he was cleaning up Manhattan. And so as I was riding downtown reading the Wall Street Journal, it was not uncommon to see someone sleeping on the train who was likely experiencing homelessness and seeing police officers, you know, removing these people pretty forcibly from the subway. And I was busy doing mergers and acquisitions, and I was very focused, you know, selfishly focused on myself. But those incidents really touched me. And I was like, you know, this is kind of hard to watch. Mm. And I would also kind of think like, I wonder where these people are going.
Yeah.
And so as I realized after living in New York City for a couple of years, that this cleaning up Manhattan was a spatial solution to a problem. It wasn't ending homelessness. It was relocating the problem such that Manhattan was pleasant for people like me who worked and lived in the city and tourists, et cetera. So I then went to Chicago. I understand you both have experience at University of Illinois. I lived in Chicago for quite some time. And the private equity fund that I worked for sponsored a Little League baseball team in Cabrini Green. And this is in the late 1990s as the towers are slowly coming down.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And obviously Cabrini Green being one of the most notorious public housing projects in the United States, very close to the Gold Coast. It was a prime real estate in Chicago. And so there had been a long drive to redevelop that and create mixed income housing. And so I was working with these boys who had lived in Cabrini Green, who had radically different life experiences than I had. So it was a profound two summers for me. And as these families were being relocated, many of them to the south side, the Robert Taylor homes down by Comiskey Field, if you're familiar with the geography of Chicago. Sure. And so I kind of continued about my way and was about to turn 40. And I have some academics in my family. I'd always wanted to be a professor. And I kind of said, you know, I think I'm done with this first career. And so when I decided to get my PhD, I decided to focus on housing policy, generally speaking. And the reason I did that is because I just think housing is fundamental. So we study all sorts of important things, healthcare, education, but without housing, none of that works. What I say in my public talks is if you want a kid to learn geometry, make sure he or she has a house. Because teaching geometry without a house doesn't work.
So great. Yeah.
And if we want people to be healthy, make sure they're housed. You know, Margot Kuschel, who's an amazing homelessness researcher, she's a physician at University of California, San Francisco. And she says, I'm a physician, I'm telling you, the best way to help my patients be healthy is to make sure that they're housed. So it's really kind of a Maslow argument in the sense that we got to get that taken care of before we can pursue these other outcomes in life that we think are really important. So that's a bit of the background on how I ended up focused on this.
So Greg, I want to pivot to a discussion about your book. And I think one of the fascinating constructs you discuss is the distinction between the causes of individual homelessness versus the disparity between the homeless populations in one city versus another. And I just thought, when people think about homelessness, they think about mental illness, drug abuse, life events like divorce, poverty, which certainly are precipitating events or circumstances for individuals. But it really doesn't answer the question why there are more homeless people in a city like New York or Boston or San Francisco versus Detroit or Baltimore or somewhere else. And so could you, for our listener, just set the table in the conversation from your book?
The basic thrust of the book was to explain why, you know, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, New York, and DC have far more homelessness than other places in the country. And what's important when answering that question is to honor both both causal understandings of homelessness. One of them is the individual cause. Clearly, if I'm addicted, if I'm mentally ill, if I'm poor, I'm more likely to experience homelessness. I would never dispute that. Some people get angry with me and send me angry emails saying this is a drug problem. I'm not suggesting that drugs are not an issue. But the point of the book is that the problems that we have on the coast related to homelessness are not the result of disproportionate drug use or disproportionate mental illness, or disproportionate poverty. The point is that those individual factors overlay onto structure, onto a housing market that is either more kind and gentle or very vicious, as we have on our coast. And so when you overlay individual vulnerability with a really, really tight housing market, you end up with much higher rates of homelessness. And these individual factors that get way more attention in the newspaper, way more attention in public narrative, are visible. And so what I say is that if you are vulnerable in a place with really, really difficult housing markets, you're more likely to experience homelessness. And so then people walk down the street in Seattle and see Joe on the street and say, well, of course, Joe's homeless. He's addicted. And it's, so it's easy, and I understand why people make that connection. But what we're missing is that there are Joes in other cities that are finding housing because it's more, it's cheaper and more accessible. And so that's what we have to really understand. If we, if the goal is to reduce levels of homelessness in our cities, we have to focus on these structural issues. It doesn't mean that treatment isn't important. It doesn't mean that we don't have a moral or ethical obligation to provide treatment, but that's just part of the solution.
It's so interesting. I don't want to just talk about this for a second before we move on. In the housing circles in New York, for years, we've talked about, you know, how the housing problem became through the, you know, the 2000s and into today, a less visible problem. The visible manifestation of the housing problem in New York now is homelessness. Back when Kirk and I started in this work in New York City, the visible manifestation of the housing problem in New York City was vacant buildings, right? Driving down the Cross Bronx Expressway, and you just see rows and rows and rows of vacant buildings. And so people had this thing like, oh my gosh, we need to do something about those vacant buildings. Because the visible manifestation of housing is homelessness, we sometimes get pigeonholed to think that we just need to build more housing for the homeless, which we absolutely need to do. To your point, I'm not suggesting that we don't need to do that. We need to build supportive housing. We need to build, you know, single room occupancy. We need to do all of those things, right? But it's a bigger issue than just building housing for the homeless, right? There's this whole issue of the supply and demand imbalance that's harder for people to see. They're harder for them to understand. You talk about this as a big part of the issue. This was a big thing that came up in your panel at the Robin Hood thing. And so I just wanted to just take a minute and have you talk a little bit about sort of this broader question of, we don't just need to build housing for homeless, right? We need to actually overall increase, make housing more available for everybody to help sort of drive down homelessness.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of my frustrations with this field from an academic standpoint is we segregate housing from homelessness research. And so I actually have colleagues who, you know, we write all sorts of articles, not about homelessness, but just about housing market conditions, you know, rent burden, for example. And we, and I've written a bunch of papers on that. And I will have people that I really respect say, oh, no, I don't study homelessness. I study housing. And I, what I always say is, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And I'm a homelessness researcher and I'm a housing researcher. And my goal is to bring these together. And I think, you know, what I say to people in Seattle, and I'm sure it's the same situation in New York, is if you go to a party and people talk about the housing market, it's either how much money I've made in my house or how much my rent is or my kids can't afford to live here. But it always comes up. It's like topic 1A. And in Seattle, because of our unsheltered homelessness crisis, homelessness is right there. And what I say is, third grade teachers can't afford to live in Seattle right now. It's just too expensive. And if you want to be a third grade teacher in Seattle, you probably have to live an hour, hour and a half away and commute in. And that to me is not a recipe for a healthy, vibrant, productive community. But the same housing crisis that's making it very difficult for that third grade teacher is also producing the crisis of homelessness. Right. It manifests itself differently for different people, but it's one and the same. And we just all are along this distribution, and it affects all of us in slightly different ways. If you're fortunate enough to be a homeowner, this crisis is actually good for you because it is, it's pushing up home values. And so it's this almost kind of perverse effect that it's impacting everyone just in different ways. And obviously the most acute and the most troubling consequence of this is the people who are on the streets experiencing homelessness, whether it's in New York or Seattle or elsewhere.
I think one of the things you do a great job of is setting up misconceptions and then explaining why they don't make sense in the context of this conversation about the disparity of homelessness city to city. And one of those things you raise is this concept of cities like New York, which happens to be a right to shelter city. And for our listener, as a result of a 1981 consent decree, the city of New York has committed to housing homeless people, providing room and board in perpetuity as a practical matter. And so if you're homeless as an individual or family in New York, the city of New York must house you. And so the concept that cities that spend that kind of money to house homeless individuals and families become a magnet for homeless individuals is a common thought process, but you suggest that's not really the case.
Yeah, I think the mobility argument is one of the most common narratives. I hear this all the time when I'm on the road, and I've probably been to about 35 cities in the last 12 months or so. And basically, everyone believes they're a magnet. New York being the biggest example. California obviously believes that they're a magnet for homelessness. Seattle believes they're a magnet for homelessness. Minneapolis did when I was there in graduate school. They thought they were a magnet for homelessness. My favorite anecdote is we include a story about Middletown, Ohio in the book, who believes they're a magnet for homelessness because of their generosity. Right. And it's not to make fun of Middletown, Ohio, but the point is like everyone can't be a magnet. And so is there an anecdote to the contrary? Of course. I'm sure someone did move to New York to get benefits. I'm sure someone moved to California to get benefits. But when you look at the data overall, what we don't see is people moving to locations with more generous benefits. We can look at TANF, which is the primary welfare program, huge state-to-state variation. We don't see that. We also know independently that state-to-state mobility among low-income households is very low. Why? Because moving is hard. You know, it takes resources. Social networks are really important. They become increasingly important. The less income you have, are you really going to leave Chicago for New York? Are you going to leave, I always say, are you going to leave, you know, Topeka, Kansas to go to LA for their quote generous benefits? How am I going to get there? What am I going to do when I get to LA? I don't have a job, et cetera. And so practically, when you step back, people say, oh yeah, that does make sense. Why would people be moving across the country with no resources and no social network to take advantage of some minor benefits? So we do see, and we talk about this in the book, that there is a suburban to urban core mobility story, which is why regional solutions are really important. So we definitely see people, for example, from the suburbs of Seattle coming into the urban core because that's where the shelters are, that's where transportation is, that's where other services are. But the idea that people are moving from state to state just doesn't hold up. Margot Kuschel at UCSF just published an amazing study of homelessness in California, and they found that 90% of the people experiencing homelessness in California are from California. And so what we need to do is look in the mirror and recognize that this is a homegrown problem, and it's something that we have collectively created, and therefore we have a collective obligation to figure out what to do about it. We can't blame people from other states here as much as we want to.
It's so interesting to me the way perception drives so much of the policy conversation. You know, Kirk and I, one of the things we did when we were a lot younger was we did a lot of community organizing in East St. Louis, Illinois. And when you talk to, you know, your friends, you know, back on campus, or you talk to your friends back home about what you were doing in East St. Louis, Illinois at that time, and unfortunately still today, is one of the poorest cities in the United States, very, you know, challenged from basic services. And, you know, the response you'd get is, well, I don't know, why would anybody live there? Why don't they just move? Well, you know, the answer is one, they don't have a lot of options. And two, they like their community. They want to make it better. They don't want to leave, right? And so this whole notion that poor folks are moving just because they want to, I mean, I haven't seen the data, but I would love to see the data just even in New York City and whether, you know, folks are moving from borough to borough to different housing options, or whether they're really staying where their networks are, where their communities are, right? That's where what people want. They want to be where their networks and communities are. It's the outliers that move, you know, because moving is hard. Moving is hard for anybody. It's really hard if you don't have a lot of money. And I think one of the other things that you talk about, and I'll transition to this with my question, is one of the things you talk a lot about in the book is another one of these assumptions, which is that homelessness is a bigger problem in poor communities than it is in more affluent communities. I mean, you talk about in the book how regionally homelessness rates are actually lower where poverty rates are higher. And one of the most interesting things you say is that at a city level, you know, poverty isn't really what's causing homelessness. It's almost the reverse. And that's that affluence is a big part of what is driving the housing problem and therefore homelessness. And so, number one, did I get that right? Am I right that that's part of the narrative here? And two, it sounds counterintuitive, but help our listener understand what you mean by that and how those things are connected.
Yeah, you did get that right. And this is, you know, we lead with this. I lead with this one in my public talks because it is a complete head scratcher. And you know, and if any of your listeners have gone to graduate school, this is what we call unitive analysis, meaning we can study causation at the individual level, we can study causation at the community level. We start by saying at the individual level, if you are poor, you are more likely to experience homelessness. Homelessness is obviously a poverty problem. There's no doubt about that. When we move to the community level, though, what we see is homelessness thrives amidst affluence, not amidst poverty. So Seattle, San Francisco, and Boston are the three most affluent cities just from an income standpoint in the United States, have three of the highest rates of homelessness, along with New York and LA and DC. Detroit is the most impoverished big city in the United States by far, by far in terms of percentage of people below the federal poverty line, and have far lower rates of homelessness. So what I always have to, I have to provide a caveat, which is the point is not that poverty doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is that being poor in a really affluent city has different consequences than being poor in Detroit, where housing is cheaper and more accessible. That's the thrust.
You know, I grew up in Rochester, New York, in Rust Belt town. That's relatively affordable place to live. And while there is homelessness in Rochester for sure, and there's homelessness in Detroit, it's not at the same level that it is in high income areas. So it's really, I think that's a really important point that you make. And you know, Kirk and I talk about this in a different way all the time, which is we talk about it as it relates to, you know, as it relates to what's the solution for housing people in New York City that make, you know, they have a family of four and they make $20,000 a year, right? They're working, but they're only making $20,000-$25,000 a year. They can't afford the rent, right? It costs $1,000 basically a month per unit just to keep the lights on and maintain a building and do all those things. And so when you think about it that way, and then you think about, you know, $20,000 a year is a poverty wage, right? It begins to make a little bit more sense. And I think, you know, your book does a great job of driving that point home.
An associated point is on the matter of race, which, you know, in a city like New York, where we our official shelter census is beyond 80,000. The Department of Homeless Services census is done daily, and they're well beyond 80,000. And the shelter system in New York has got to be 90-something% people of color, and it's disproportionately people of color because they're disproportionately represented in the income bands that are vulnerable. So anyway, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the overlay of race, you know, and homelessness generally, if you would, for a few minutes.
Sure. Yeah. So we can't talk about homelessness without talking about race. So Black, Brown, Indigenous people are 3 to 4 times overrepresented in the homeless population relative to their percentage of the overall general population. And what's interesting is when we're explaining regional variation, what we highlight is that race doesn't explain regional variation. Race, and more importantly, racism, determines who is more likely to experience homelessness in a given city. If it was simply race that produced homelessness, Chicago should have a far higher homeless population than Seattle, which is a predominantly white city. Chicago has a much higher Black population than Seattle. What's interesting, and I didn't realize this until after I'd published the book, I ran the numbers. The disproportionality of Black people in the homeless population in Seattle is identical to Chicago. It's just from a different base.
Wow.
It was like 3.5 times or something like that. So it really comes down to identifying, you know, racial injustice in all sorts of systems, housing, education, criminal justice, healthcare, have produced, and this has gone on for centuries, as we know from our unfortunate history in this country, have produced this disproportionality. And it's highlighting who is most likely to experience homelessness. And so if we walk around on the streets on the West Coast with unsheltered homelessness, if you go into the shelter systems of New York and Boston, what you're going to see is a lot of people of color. And for these very reasons, because of these systems. And so centering racial justice in these conversations is essential. It's absolutely essential because this is clearly a poverty problem, this is a housing problem, and this is a racial justice problem. No doubt about it.
Let's change course a little bit and talk a little bit about, you know, some solutions or some ideas about solutions. And, you know, one of the things just to even start this is there's this ongoing debate about whether cities like New York are ever going to be able to solve homelessness. There's lots of people who think, you know, we shouldn't ever talk about solving homelessness. Yet, on the other hand, you know, we had many years where the federal government made that one of their priorities was solving homelessness. And so outside of solving it, because I presume over the course of the next 20 minutes, I mean, if you do have the idea for solving it in the next 20 minutes, we should talk about it. But short of that, you know, what are the, you've been traveling around cities, obviously talking about this book, you've been studying this problem for a long time. You know, what are the things from a solutions oriented perspective that you've seen or that you think are the things that we need to do to try to start to get to having an impact on the problem?
Sure. So I think just to set the stage for my response, you know, what we conclude in the book and demonstrate is that in cities with really high rents and low vacancies, you end up with lots of homelessness.
Right.
And that's what explains regional variation. That's why New York, Boston, DC, Seattle, San Francisco, LA have more homelessness than Chicago or Detroit or St. Louis or whatever. And so if we buy the argument that there's a link between housing market conditions and rates of homelessness, then obviously part of our attention should be on housing market conditions.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, looking at the level of rents, looking at vacancies has a really, really important influence on rates of homelessness. If vacancies continue to be 3% and rents are 2,000 in the city, you're going to have homelessness. You're going to have homelessness. And so when I travel around, I've been amazed because I pull up the census data whenever I go to a community. I was in Wichita last week. I've been to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I've been to Kentucky twice, in addition to visiting the coast. And what I'm seeing is a compression of vacant rental market vacancy rates in places that I would never have imagined.
Right.
The rental market vacancy rate in the state of Iowa is 5% right now, which I would have lost a lot of money betting on that before I pulled it up. I would have thought it was 7, 8, 9%. And so the fact that we're seeing compression in locations that typically have had pretty affordable and ample supply of housing is a huge concern. And so since publishing the book, what we're seeing is there, instead of things getting better, what we're seeing is more cities looking more like coastal cities, Austin, Texas being the prime example.
Yeah,
vacancy rates going from 8.5% to 2.5% over 10 years. Really tight compression of housing markets. And so there are a lot of different answers, and I wish I could solve this in the next 20 minutes. But depending on the city and the location you're in, the answers are different. So we can talk about the coast right now. And then what I want to do is move into other cities that maybe don't have the same issues that we do. If on the West Coast, 50% of our people are unsheltered. And so the debate is, do we build permanent housing or do we build more shelter?
Yeah.
Do we become New York 2.0?
Right.
And because the unsheltered crisis is a raging fire and people are demanding solutions, people say, well, I was just in New York. We didn't see as much homelessness. I said, they have more homelessness than anywhere in the country. They're just hiding it better than we are.
That's right.
So that's the debate on the West Coast, is do we build more shelter capacity or more permanent housing? And the answer is we probably need to do both in those cities. In Boston, in New York, in DC, the question then becomes is, do we continue to fund, put billions and billions of dollars into the shelter system, or do we figure out how to get people through this system and into some permanent housing? And the scary thing about that is building housing in New York City is really expensive.
Yeah.
And that will require a big commitment. It will require political will, things that unfortunately at times are in short supply, not just in New York City, but all around the country. So the challenge we have on the coast is tough. And so because eliminating may or may not be feasible, that doesn't mean we can't try. And we can't try to get these per capita rates down, because that would be definitely a success. And so we have to think about this flow of people. There is a role for shelter, but we can't warehouse people, for lifetimes in the shelter system. We just can't. So I think that's the challenge on the coast right now. And clearly, especially on the West Coast, what we've done a really poor job of is thinking about housing supply, San Francisco being the most inelastic housing supply in the United States.
Right.
Strict regulatory environment, challenging topography. You layer a tech boom on top of that and you end up with a crazy housing market. And so we have to figure out how to construct more housing in those communities. And part of that is going to be land use. Seattle's own 70-75% single family. That has got to change. We can't have an Amazon and Microsoft tech boom and have 3/4 of our parcels zone single family. There's just no place to put people.
Yeah.
And so the problem is that when you don't build enough housing, people say, we didn't build housing for Amazon people. That's the wrong interpretation. What we didn't do is build housing for incumbent residents who've now been displaced, because the Amazon people are going to find housing.
Yeah,
they have resources. So that's kind of the challenge on the West Coast. In the interior of the country, what has been really interesting is what I say is, don't repeat the mistakes that we made. As your communities grow, as you have increased employment, all of which are good things, you need to make sure that you're pairing housing production with employment growth. And one of the most rewarding thing that has happened in my travels is I've been to Kentucky twice. The last time I was there, then governor, and he was just reelected, Andy Beshear, spoke right before me. And there was a line in our book, which is called Homes Are Where Jobs Go at Night. The idea being that we need to pair these two concepts,
right.
That we use the levers of government to increase employment, and then we forget about the housing.
That's right.
And when he stood up and said, in the state of Kentucky, every time we announce a jobs program through economic development, we're also going to announce a commitment to housing. And it's a pretty simple thing. And I was just like, it was very rewarding, selfishly speaking. It felt great to hear. And they said, because we want to avoid the problems that other states have had. And obviously the ship has sailed for New York and Seattle. We don't have the luxury of kind of
we gotta play
slack in the system.
Right.
We have to play catch up. That's exactly right. And so, you know, I think folks are doing that. And I think fundamentally the real challenge is that as from a national government, from a federal government, we have a limited housing program. You know, 1 in 4 people who are eligible for housing support get it. And that pushes these really challenging issues down to state and local governments who don't have the resources of the feds. And so fixing this without help from DC, I think, is going to be hard.
It's
going
really
to put huge pressure on the state of New York, huge pressure on the state of Washington. And so, but I do think with some help from the feds, with local commitments to produce housing, we can make a huge dent in this.
Yeah.
It's 582,000 people as of the, you know, it's going to, let's say it's around 600,000. We know the number is actually larger than that, but there's 30 plus million people in poverty in the United States. Let's say there's 1 million people experiencing homelessness, maybe 2 throughout the course of a year. That's a problem we can fix.
Yeah.
It absolutely is a problem we can fix. Not with our current trajectory,
right?
But we can fix it.
So what's interesting to me about, there's multiple things in here to talk about, but what's interesting to me about the first part of what you said, which is, you know, this inelasticity of the housing markets, right? Where you've got, you know, low vacancy rates, right? And high rents. We're coming off a time since the Great Recession where housing production, rental housing production has actually been higher than almost any other time in my lifetime, right? Because, but home ownership production has been down, right? But we've also had this interesting dynamic that I haven't checked the data on lately, but household formation has been, you know, at all time highs, right? So people don't really think about this when they're thinking about the problem. It's not just about, are we building, right? It's also, are we building enough to keep up with the households that actually are forming and want to find housing, right? And so, you know, you look at Austin, I mean, you go to Austin, they're building everywhere in Austin, right? I mean, there's, you know, you mentioned Austin. I mean, I was there a year and a half ago and they were building, you know, building everywhere, right? But they're not keeping up with demand. And that's really the challenging thing. We have this shift that's been happening since the Great Recession to rental housing and household formation that has been driving up demand for rental housing. And so we're still behind, even though we've actually, when you just look at the raw numbers, we've actually been, as a nation, we've been producing more rental housing in the last, you know, 10 years, 12 years than we have, you know, historically. And so it's a really challenging time to think about supply. And then I go, and this is the thing that I wanted to just get your thoughts on a little bit, because you mentioned 1 in 4, you know, people that are eligible for housing assistance get it, right? Kirk and I talk about this a lot on the housing problem, that building is not the only answer, right? Some of this is we just have to get more income to people to be able to afford, you know, a unit that they could rent through rental assistance. And the federal government is the only place that's going to be able to do that at scale, right? The federal government has a massive housing incentive program. It's called the mortgage interest deduction, which we don't like to talk about, but it's a massive, it's a massive housing subsidy, right? And so talk a little bit about this question of supply versus also demand side approaches. And how you see those, you know, either working together or, you know, helping to drive a solution.
Yeah, I think there's a role for both. And I think your household formation point is really, really important. I think it was the Joint Center at Harvard published a study about this earlier this year. When I read it, I knew this, but it was really interesting when you lay it out to think about a generation ago, everyone got married at 25. In this generation, people are partnering at 35 or 40. And that 15 years now, we have 2 households instead of 1. And that just creates a huge demand for housing. And a lot of those folks are going to rent, especially if you're living in an urban city. And so without dramatic population growth, we've really had huge demand for rental housing. And as you said, we have constructed rental housing, just not at a sufficient rate. And so, you know, Austin being a prime example where through 2019, through the data in our book, they had maintained sufficient housing supply to accommodate the demand. A lot of that was through sprawl, which some people might say that's not the ideal solution, but still it does demonstrate that if you build housing units, you can do it. And they just couldn't keep up. Like, you know, during COVID, more people leaving the Bay Area, going to Austin, and the place just exploded. And now if you read the Austin newspaper, it's housing and homelessness every day, right there. I was just down there last month, and it's become a major, major issue. So I think the question then becomes is this a supply story? Is this a, you know, should we just provide more demand side benefits? And I would say it's location dependent.
Yeah.
You know, what we know from the voucher program is that we could increase voucher capacity in New York City and Seattle, and the impact might be far more muted than we would like because there's not availability of units. And landlords say, well, I have 10 people want to rent. Why would I go through the difficulty of leasing to a voucher tenant when I could just lease to you know, a private market, a renter? And so, whereas there are other places where increased voucher capacity could have a huge impact in the sense that you have 9% vacancies, there's empty units, landlords would be happy to have you. They now have government backed, you know, your credit counterparty is the US government. That's pretty good. And so let's get those folks in there. And so I do think that there's an opportunity to, to think about, you know, there's actually a colleague, Kirk McClure, has been at the University of Kansas. He's retired now, but he has been writing about housing issues for a long time. And Kirk had a really interesting idea, which was, why don't we target our demand side program in markets where they can be used and really push our supply side, meaning tax credit financing, and push those to the places where we need supply? Because, for example, you know, in Seattle, I would trade our voucher capacity for more tax credits. And if you're in Cincinnati, they might say, let's just get, it's easier. Let's just increase our voucher capacity and let the tax credits go to places where we need more supply. And so I think there's a blend, and I think it depends on the location. And then clearly just getting money in people's pockets helps. We know from some of these basic income studies that they are effective. HUD is actually doing a really interesting study, which is an experiment around cash-based, instead of vouchers, just providing cash rental assistance. So it'll be interesting to see what they see in the results of that. And so clearly there's an income story. One of the challenges, though, is when people will say, well, Greg, this is just, we just have to, people just need more money and this will take care of itself. And I'll say, well, let's just think about the math in Seattle right now. We have an $18 minimum wage. You work full-time. That's $36,000 a year. There's not housing for you at that level. And so what minimum wage would be required to allow for stable housing for everyone in Seattle? And it's going to be a number that is politically unpalatable.
That's right.
The restaurant industry would freak out if you went out and said, we need a $40 minimum wage. They would just say, we can't do this. And so is it an income story? Absolutely. Is it a housing supply story? Absolutely.
Can't do it.
And, you know, I think, and our, the title of our book was intentionally provocative. And we wanted to get people and say, well, no, it's more than that, Greg. Yes, it is. And if you read the book, you'll see that. But we wanted to be really clear is this is not a drug problem.
Right.
You know, and so could you write a book saying this is an inequality problem? Yes. Could you write a book saying this is a racial injustice problem? Yes, you could.
That's right.
You know, housing problem, et cetera. And so that's kind of the way I'm viewing some of these challenges.
One of the things that as a developer, and Raphael and I are business partners on the development side, one of the things that's hard to stomach is how long it takes for projects to be entitled and for them ultimately to get building permits. And you had a stat, which I was fascinated by. I think it was one of the West Coast cities where it takes developers 700 days to get a building permit. In New York, our rezonings and entitlements of multifamily rental can take 10 years plus. And so the one of the hallmarks of so-called progressively led cities is the resistance to development, the suspicion that developers endure, and ultimately the delay that results, which means that people who need housing are getting it 5, 10, 15 years later. And the cities that are supposed to be progressive and compassionate often are the places where people who are most vulnerable suffer the most. And so I wanted you, as sort of the last piece of the conversation with respect to supply to talk about that, you know, to talk about that dichotomy about, you know, supposed compassion and the resulting suffering of folks who are waiting on housing for unbelievable lengths of time.
Yeah, it's a great point. So one of the points in the book is, you know, so President Trump and Governor Gavin Newsom of California got in a big public battle when Trump was in office. And Trump's blaming Democrats on the West Coast for homelessness, and Gavin Newsom's blaming the federal government, and back and forth, back and forth. And what we write in the book is that Democrats run cities in the United States. And so if you want to blame Democrats for homelessness, it's hard to do that because they didn't produce the same crisis in St. Louis and Detroit and Baltimore, for example. Now, but what I say is Democrats are not blameless for the very reason that Kirk just highlighted, which is in cities, especially like San Francisco, which that was that 700 days point from San Francisco. You know, people are dying in the streets and we're taking 2 years just to issue, you know, a permit, for heaven's sakes. And so that is, I think, where governors and mayors of coastal cities, they have to account for this. And the reality is that we have let this build, let this problem build because of resistance, community resistance to development. And sometimes that might be in the guise of neighborhood character. In some cases, it might be due to environmentalism, whatever the case may be. It has exacted a huge cost on these communities, and that has to change. And so what I always say in my comments is, I'm not opposed to regulation. There's a role for regulation in society. I want my ground beef to be safe. I want people to live in homes that are safe, all those things. But there's a line between reasonable regulation and taking 2 years, 10 years to get housing built that we desperately need. It's absolutely. And I think that's, unfortunately, it's too late, but I think coastal cities and coastal states are now figuring that out. And so we have to understand that those delays not only delay housing for people who need it, the carrying costs for developers are immense, and it just increases the cost of housing in considerable ways. And so figuring out how we can fast track entitlements is absolutely essential. And, you know, design review, I'm not a designer. I am a social scientist, and I think about this more economically, but I'm in a college with architects, and we talk about this all the time of when design review is used to as a weapon against development, that's an issue. And so we have to think about all of these issues. And unfortunately, many of these issues come down to the ideals of democracy.
Yeah.
The Planning Commission has a meeting and says, in the interest of democracy, we're going to invite everyone impacted by this to opine. And who shows up? A bunch of 55, 60-year-old white single-family homeowners who say, I don't want multifamily development in my neighborhood. I don't want those people in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Which can be code for racism, classism, whatever the case may be. And the members of the city council, their planning commission say, well, only four people showed up and they all said no. Right. You know, in the interest of democracy, the answer is no. And so we do that night after night after night, year after year, right. And we end up with a really screwed up housing system. And so we have to rethink how we make community decisions around housing. And the reality is the people who benefit from those decisions aren't even invited to those meetings.
Yeah.
So then how do we change that? And it's not to subvert democracy, it's to really have a more kind of truly democratic process to ensure that we can create the housing that we need. And ultimately, I'm a firm believer that we just need denser cities. Yeah. New York City being obviously the outlier in the United States. The rest of the country is an absolute global outlier.
You
can't go to any other city in the world that is structured the way that Seattle or San Francisco is. It just doesn't work. And so we're going to get denser because we have to get denser, and that will create more housing and a lot of more rental housing, and we desperately need it. And it's going to be really tough politically.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, and I thought that this, when you said that you would trade voucher capacity for tax credit capacity in Seattle, my reaction to that with my New York lens was, I'm not sure we could build more in New York because of a combination of we're already so dense and it's hard to find places to build, right? And the community process, the democracy at work, stopping even 100% affordable projects run into problems getting approval because they don't like this or they don't like that. And honestly, like, I don't know whether we could absorb that, you know, in New York. Whereas our governor in New York came out, you know, when she announced her housing plan and equated, you know, this, the question of jobs and housing to when she grew up in Buffalo and all the jobs left and everybody had housing. Housing was easy, right?
Yep.
And now we're in a situation where we've created all these jobs and we don't have the housing, and our neighboring states are actually building at higher rates than we are. And maybe that's fine because it's part of regional solutions, as you talk about. But I, you know, at the end of the day, New York, I don't know if we could build more in New York.
Yep.
Right. And that's really fundamentally, I think what our challenge is, our myopic view, in New York. And I don't know that we can build more with government having to play the biggest role, which is why we need some more simplistic ways for developers to be able to build.
Could I just follow up on that point real quickly? You know, I think the other benefit is, you know, as I said, I would trade vouchers for tax credits potentially, but the other thing, the other benefit of vouchers, and it's not immediate, is it makes all this production a lot easier if you know you're going to get market rate rents. And absolutely. So my dream scenario is if we made vouchers an entitlement in the United States, meaning 4 out of 4 instead of 1 out of 4, get it. Immediately, it might be hard to use that, you know, if we flooded Seattle with vouchers. But ultimately, what we'll see is a supply effect.
That's right.
Because even with tax credits, if you layer a voucher in there, the math is way easier.
Absolutely.
And so, the dream is an expansion of the voucher program paired with state and local commitments to increase housing production. And then you can really start to make a dent in this thing. Unfortunately, when I say like trading credits for vouchers, that's in a regime of scarcity. Meaning we can't move it. And so then we're allocating insufficient resources. What's the best way? That's really the wrong question. The question is ideally, what could we do? That would make a huge difference.
Yeah,
that would make a huge difference. And, there was a possibility of expansion in the Build Back Better plan that ultimately didn't make it through. And I know HUD was and housing advocates were really pushing for that. And unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But there are pathways. We just have not prioritized them, unfortunately.
No,
but you still have the issue that you have, which is where do you get the capacity in New York City, for example? And that's tough.
And that was really well said. And Kirk would help, solve the problem you've been struggling with these days, which is that rents cover so little of your development costs that the cost of subsidy in New York is through the roof because the rents are being driven so low without the vouchers. And so you could change that quickly if you did that. Well, Greg, we're unfortunately out of time. I think we could keep going on this for another hour. So we might have to have you back. We'll see. But thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Helping us sort through this problem and, helping bring a broader national lens to the issues. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Raphael. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having me.
Thank you again to Greg Colburn, professor at the University of Washington and author of Homelessness as a Housing Problem, How Structural Problems Explain U.S. Patterns. We really hope these conversations will lead to a greater understanding of the housing problem and its potential solutions. We hope you're enjoying listening to the Housing Problem podcast. I'm Raphael Sestero.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. You can contact us and find out more about affordable housing in New York City and nationally at thehousingproblem.com.
And please remember to subscribe and share The Housing Problem, because the more we explore the housing problem, the better chance we have of finding the solution.
Produced by Paul Jamali. Executive producers Raphael Sestero, Kirk Goodrich, Eric Biederman, and Tom Corsillo. The Housing Problem podcast is a top content production for Merino PR.